This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield approval. If you qualify and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A generation has passed since a law professor named Anita Hill testified to senators about the sexual harassment she said she experienced from then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. He was confirmed and remains on the court today. The echoes of 1991 are deafening. Judge Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the nation's highest court was controversial, but also appeared to be on track until allegations of sexual assault from his student days played out in the media. And suddenly his conduct and his character came under sharp scrutiny in the press as well as on Capitol Hill. His accusers have come in for a rough ride, too. The media is hurtling after an ever-shifting target, but let's stop, listen, and ask. How well has the media served the public on this? Have we struck the right balance? How has the coverage affected how we think about this nomination and this nominee? What has the media learned since 1991? This hour on Point, the media, Brett Kavanaugh, and his accusers. You can join us on air or online. What's your take on how all this has played out? Did the media make this better or worse? Has it informed you more or less? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Jane Mayer. She's the chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. This past Sunday, she published a story co-written with Ronan Farrow, which detailed allegations of sexual assault from another woman against Brett Kavanaugh. This morning, she has a piece entitled, quote, "Emails show that Republican Senate staff stymied a Kavanaugh accuser's effort to give testimony." Jane, thanks so much for joining us on a busy, busy week.
So glad to be with you.
So you literally wrote the book on the Clarence Thomas nomination with, of course, Jill Abramson, and on Anita Hill's accusations, how the Senate handled that. What did you see when you watched this week?
Oh, gosh, I feel like I'm having PTSD. It's a flashback to the Anita Hill-Clarence Thomas nomination fight. It's kind of eerie how many of the details are the same. But, you know, in some ways, I suppose I feel distressed that was famously seen as kind of a low moment in Supreme Court nominations and in terms of confirmation hearings. And I feel we've maybe scraped even lower on this one.
Scraped
in so
lower.
Many different ways, yeah.
Why?
Well, the process was, it just didn't have the ring of fairness, which is what the problem was in the Anita Hill situation as well. Both sides are accusing each other of running a sham process, and the president's called it a sham, and Senator Grassley and Senator Lindsey Graham have called it a sham, and but so do the Democrats feel it's been a sham. In all sides feel like the process didn't work. You've got a number of women here, who, including the one that Ronan Farrow and I wrote about, Deborah Ramirez, who's a classmate of Brett Kavanaugh's at Yale, and you've got Christine Blasey Ford, two women, both of whom wanted the FBI to come in. They wanted a neutral fact-finding body to come in and get the facts, and they were denied that. And so without that, it had the look of a court hearing, but it didn't have the factual evidence of a court hearing. And so it's just a lot of, you know, finger pointing and histrionics then.
So let's go to your story for a moment about Deborah Ramirez. She was, you say, was a classmate at Yale. She alleges, and folks, this stuff gets graphic, and let's acknowledge that. But she essentially alleges that at a party at Yale, a very drunk young Brett Kavanaugh, I believe, waved his penis in her face, and that he was involved in essentially mocking her and degrading her in the process. And she wanted a hearing for that. She was not heard by the Senate. This stirred a lot of criticism of Kavanaugh, but also people questioned your story. They said, was this strong enough to go? Tell us about what you thought made this publishable and important for us to know.
Sure. This is, again, a credible woman, a classmate at Yale. who is on the record telling a story firsthand of what she remembers that happened to her. She's willing and actually calling for the FBI to take a statement from her, and the Senate was investigating it. It had reached the point where it was unavoidable to write about it. To not write about it would have been a cover-up, basically. And we're not in the business of cover-ups. But I feel also it's worth pointing out that she had a number of validators. She had an attorney who was the district attorney in Boulder, Colorado for many years, who said she was the most credible client he'd had in his 35 years. She has a number of classmates who've gone on the record to say she is incredibly and memorably truthful and guileless. And I even called the Kavanaugh confirmation team and asked, who can I talk to? Do you have anything that someone who might think that want to say something that casts aspersions on her story? And I spoke to the witnesses they gave me, and I asked these people who only would talk on background, is she motivated by politics? They said no. I asked, are you saying you think she's lying? They said no. This is a very strong story, and it's just, I think, one of the things that's created a problem and a sense that the process is unfair, that she never got a chance to tell it in any kind of national forum.
Yesterday, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, Brett Kavanaugh blamed the media for heightening the allegations and the intensity of the scrutiny he was facing.
And then, as no doubt was expected, if not planned, came a long series of false last-minute smears designed to scare me and drive me out of the process before any hearing occurred. Crazy stuff. Gangs, illegitimate children, fights on boats in Rhode Island. All nonsense, reported breathlessly and often uncritically by the media.
Judge Kavanaugh said that a lot of the stuff, that the allegations against him are all uncorroborated. I think in your reporting you've said this may not be proven, but that it is corroborated. What corroboration did you have for the accusations of Deborah Ramirez and what happened in New Haven so many years ago?
So for Deborah Ramirez, I spoke to another classmate who was in the same dorm who remembered very distinctly 35 years ago hearing about it either that night of the party or the next day or the next day after that. And he is a very credible, distinguished person at this point. And I said to him, are you sure that it was about Brett Kavanaugh? He said, I am 100% sure. But the problem you get is that there's a party here that is being alleged, and you've got other guys who are involved, and I know their names from having us, Ronan Farrow, my partner on the story, interviewed Deborah Ramirez, and they won't go on the record denying it, but they'll say on background they weren't there. But then, of course, the thing is, the dilemma for a reporter is, you're never going to find people who are implicated in some kind of embarrassing and potentially criminal situation to stand up and say, yes, I participated in it, and so did this friend of mine who is about to be confirmed to the Supreme Court. It would be nice if people acted like that, but it's very rare, which is why, of course, the call came out from Deborah Ramirez, as it did from Christine Blasey Ford, bring in the FBI. Because people will say one thing to a reporter, I don't remember, basically, is what people will say. And then when they're under oath and being interviewed by the FBI and they could go to jail if they lie, they might tell a little more.
Mm-hmm. In recent days, the Senate Judiciary Committee explaining why they didn't call Ramirez Ford said, hey, we really tried to get her to talk to us. We thought we wanted to make it happen, and it didn't. And she ultimately didn't want to cooperate. In today's story, you're saying not exactly how that played out.
No, we got the email correspondence back and forth between Deborah Ramirez's lawyers and the Judiciary Committee staff, which, you know, the committee's the chairmanship is in it's a Republican run committee. And if you take a look at the emails back and forth, it's hard not to come away thinking that they far preferred for her to stay in Boulder, Colorado, than take a step towards Washington, D.C. and tell her story. They basically kept saying, sure, we'll take a phone call from you as soon as you send all of the evidence that you have of this. And her lawyer would say, well, can we just get on the phone? Because we're afraid if we send you the evidence we have, in essence, they would give it to Brett Kavanaugh, who was preparing for the hearings. And they needed to know that there was some kind of assurance that there was a fair process there. And in the end of the day, the communications broke down, and the committee never got on the phone with her lawyers.
Fascinating. I do want, in the about a minute that we have left before I have to relinquish you, ask you a bit. You know, your coverage of Clarence Thomas, so important to our understanding of that episode in American history. The allegations that Professor Hill brought forward involved things he had done while head of the EEOC, which is a federal agency looking out over the workplace. This involved, you know, that you report on an incident that happened during college and was probably pretty fleeting. Why was it important the public knew about this?
In much the way that in judging Anita Hill's credibility, one of the great helps to trying to figure out who's telling the truth is to see whether there's a pattern of behavior. And in the case of Clarence Thomas, it turned out there was, but it took a long time for the facts to surface. In the case of Brett Kavanaugh, it would be useful to know if there are other instances of women who have felt that he treated them that he engaged in sexual misconduct towards them, and so it's a question. Really, it goes towards the credibility of Christine Blasey Ford. Are there other women who've had similar experiences? There was one who wanted to say that she did, but she didn't get to get a hearing.
Much like Deborah Ramirez, the subject of your stories in the last week. You've been hearing the voice of Jane Mayer. She's the chief Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Jane, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, David. So good to be with you.
We're discussing how the media has covered Brett Kavanaugh, his nomination, and the accusations he has been facing. You can join the conversation. Weigh in. What do you think? How have you followed this story? What do you make of what's been reported? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about the media and about Brett Kavanaugh, his judicial hopes, and the accusations he faces. You can join the conversation. What changes do you see in how the media covers issues of sexual assault? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook and on the interwebs at On Point Radio. I'd like to take a couple of quick calls now. David's calling from Kingston, New Hampshire. Hi, David.
Hi, David. I listened to watched the whole event yesterday, and I'm a little concerned as I look at news this morning that it's all seeming to relate to did he or did he not way back then, and I'm wondering why the media is not focusing. I hope you all will focus before the vote on the demeanor that Kavanaugh showed us yesterday, right here, right now. He was belligerent, he was devious, he was asked direct yes-no questions, which he never, ever, ever, dozens of them, never answered. He confused the four replies, depositions, with he kept saying they refuted when they didn't. They just failed to corroborate.
So David is focusing on the demeanor, the anger, what he calls the belligerence. We also have a call from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Rudolfo, tell me what you took from all this.
Well, I take from all this that 94%, according to Judicial Watch, and that's online right now as we speak, 94% of the coverage has been negative. And I think David's got a wild card loose. He's entitled to his own fact.
He is. Let's not cast aspersions here, but go ahead.
Yeah, but 94% of the coverage has been negative. So how's a man supposed to get a even-handed hearing when confronted with this lady that's got this mousy, squeaky voice that claims that she was molested 36 years ago.
Okay, Rudolfo, so thank you for that. How can Brett Kavanaugh expect a fair hearing? Well, we're joined now from St. Petersburg, Florida, by Kelly McBride. She's the senior vice president at Poynter and a leading thinker on media ethics who's written broadly about how to cover sexual assault over the years. She's also the former ombudsman for ESPN. Kelly, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Also with us from Washington is Jane Costin. She's senior politics reporter for Vox, I should be clear. She focuses on conservatism and the American right, and she's written about the Kavanaugh confirmation process. Jane, thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, look, both sides – I want to play a couple of clips because both sides felt pretty badly used by the press. Christine Blasey Ford, in her opening statement yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee, says it's not been easy being thrust into the public light.
Apart from the assault itself, these past couple of weeks have been the hardest of my life. I've had to relive this trauma in front of the world, and I've seen my life picked apart by people on television, on Twitter, other social media, other media, and in this body who have never met me or spoken with me.
On the other side, you had Senate Judiciary Chairman Chuck Grassley, who blamed his Democratic colleague Dianne Feinstein and the media for the last-minute sexual assault allegations against Judge Kavanaugh.
Only at an 11th hour, on the eve of Judge Kavanaugh's confirmation vote, did the ranking member refer the allegations to the FBI. And then, sadly, the allegations were leaked to the press. And that's where Dr. Ford was mistreated. This is a shameful way to treat our witness who insisted on confidentiality. And, of course, Judge Kavanaugh, who has had to address these allegations in the midst of a media circus.
Kelly McBride, how fairly have Judge Kavanaugh and Professor Ford been treated?
Well, in general, that's impossible to analyze, right? Because you have hundreds and hundreds of media outlets. Some have treated them fairly. Some have treated them with disrespect. So it's really hard to say for the entire media.
Sure. Help us break it down, though. Where would you say things fall? What coverage would you point to?
Well, I would say that, Dr. Ford talked about her her relationship with the Washington Post and how she reached out to them. At first, they didn't respond to her. And then when she threatened to go to the New York Times, they did respond to her. They could have responded a little more quickly. But that said, once she started working with the reporter from the Washington Post, she felt like she was treated very fairly with a lot of dignity. Sexual assault victims frequently feel re-victimized by the system, right? And that includes the media. But then when you get into the commentary and the criticism, you heard it. You heard some of it parroted in your most recent callers analysis. You know, they attack how her voice sounds. They attack her motives. That's all quite unfair, I think. And she stood up for herself pretty well yesterday. But, the analysis comes from everybody who wants to offer an opinion, and that got quite nasty. And it did also for Judge Kavanaugh.
Jane Costin, this has obviously been a competitive story. You've seen The New Yorker, The Washington Post, and others break off elements of it, of
these accusations of sexual assault or misconduct by the judge. How have you watched – what have you seen in news organizations as they've pursued the stories? What strands do you think they're going after as it's been playing out heading towards this Senate vote?
Well, I think that there's the news itself, and then there are the reflections of the news. And so with the first strand, the news itself, I think it's been interesting that a lot of people are asking a lot of questions about the lives of high school students in 1982, and especially with relation to Kavanaugh's friends and associates. I'm thinking of Mark Judge, for instance, who his attorney told him, like, go to Bethany Beach and don't talk to anyone, because he had written extensively about his own struggles with alcoholism in high school and referenced someone named Bart O. Kavanaugh in his writing. So I think that that was a strand upon which a lot of people have focused, is that, you know, if we can find out more about the environment in which Brett Kavanaugh was allegedly, you know, having these experiences, we can find out, you know, is this true or is this not true? But then you also see the reflections of that news. And I think that that's something that's important to really get to, is that what you're hearing is not necessarily a lot of people reporting, but it's a lot of people kind of reporting on reporting. And so, you know, you have people talking about, you know, Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow's reporting, and then kind of reporting on their reporting. And there was a big back and forth between the New York Times and the New Yorker with regard to Ms. Ramirez's allegations. And so I think that there's been it's a bit of a meta-analysis of the reporting that's taking place.
Right. The New York Times, I guess, saying we weren't able to verify it, so we didn't publish it, but acknowledging that Ramirez talked to the New Yorker and didn't talk to the Times.
Yeah, and that it was more because she was speaking exclusively to the New Yorker. But something, you know, I spend a lot of time watching conservative media, and one of my big hobby horses is kind of the fall of guardrails within conservative media. And you saw that in a lot of the stories that got pushed to not just kind of not, you know, Trump supportive Twitter users, but to kind of big time conservative pundits that started out on 8chan or 4chan and then somehow find their way to Eric Erickson, who's a conservative pundit. You know, you saw people claiming that Michael Avenatti had been duped by a 4chan hoax. And that was something that got to both, you know, Mark Levin, another conservative radio host, and Eric Erickson, where they're both saying, like, well, 4chan says this. And, you know, in general, 4chan says something that does not really mean anything.
To be clear, Michael Avenatti, the attorney for Julia Swetnick, who was a third accuser, who filed a sworn statement making her own accusations against Kavanaugh. And you're saying 4chan and then conservative bled into conservative pundits saying he got duped, but it's not clear that he did.
Right. Exactly. And you have people, you know, circulating photographs of, you know, Dr. Ford with George Soros when it's not Dr. Ford. And because that there's no longer a sense that there are certain conservative media outlets that are like kind of top of the top, and then there are others that you just don't listen to, for many people, you know, it kind of bleeds in between Gateway Pundit and National Review. There's a giant gulf between those two, but online there isn't. There's been a flattening of conservative media more broadly. So you're starting to see people, you know, you're starting to see members of Congress or people with kind of high-level conservative positions. You saw that with Ed Whalen's tweets about a week ago, in which, you know, this very prominent conservative attorney, people have been talking about, you know, he has something that's going to bust this whole case wide open. And what he has is a Twitter thread that uses Zillow and a house layout of a home in, you know, in the area where Ford and Kavanaugh were growing up, to try and argue that an entirely separate person was responsible for the alleged assault.
Right.
And,
so,
you know, this
Jane,
idea
Jane Coase,
that
– Jane, let's play that actual clip, because that not only was playing out on Twitter from, as you say, Ed Whelan's Twitter feed, and he's a guy who's been directly supporting Kavanaugh throughout – but Fox News gave it a lot of play in recent days. On Fox and Friends last week, host Steve Doocy gave airtime to this theory. Whelan suggested, just as you say, that it was a Kavanaugh lookalike who assaulted Ford, and Whelan even named the suggested lookalike. Here's what Steve Doocy told Fox viewers last week.
He looked at what Christine Ford told the Washington Post and figured out, okay, these people were named, these four people, where did they live? And looked at what she had said and figured out what house it may have happened at, because it was the house closest to the golf course. Yeah. And then realized whose house it was and looked at a picture of the young man who lived there at the time, who was a classmate of Mr. Kavanaugh's, put up side by side images They look a lot alike.
So really?
Is it a case of mistaken identity? Exactly. Now, Dr. Ford put out a statement last night insisting she knows the difference between Judge Kavanaugh
Zero
and this
chance.
Other person, and there's no chance. So we'll see.
Important to note, Whelan has since apologized for this theory, but cause outrage is, Jane Costin, you think this shows the guardrails are off?
I think so. And I think, it, you know, in part, when you have motivated reasoning on both sides, and we've seen this before with how many on the left have responded to Senator Kirsten Gillibrand with regard to the allegations against former Senator Al Franken, you have motivated reasoning that is playing into how people are perceiving and digesting this information. If you want to believe that Brett Kavanaugh is innocent, you are going to want to find evidence to prove that, you know, or a hypothesis that already exists for you. If you believe that Brett Kavanaugh is not innocent, you might be more likely to believe information that's given to you that shows that he is not innocent. So I think that among conservatives, this flattening where you're having people citing websites that are well known, you know, famously for making stuff up or getting stuff wrong, and they're, you know, they're more willing to take that over the word of someone who is writing for The New Yorker, or you're having someone who is, you know, you have someone like Michael Avenatti who, you know, hasn't had the same kind of deep reporting background, shall we say, that
he's a lawyer, and you've been involved in suing the president. Let me just do this because, Kelly McBride, I want to ask you a little bit about the ways in which major news outlets approach reporting on sexual assault has changed or hasn't over the years. Have we seen anything in the generation since the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, any difference in the way the media handles accusations like these?
Oh, absolutely. I am just old enough to have been a professional during the Anita Hill trial. And I remember thinking myself and hearing many women and men, too, thinking the accusations that Anita Hill was making. It's not that people didn't believe her. It's that people didn't think it was that big of a deal, that stuff happened all the time and that she was taking it too seriously. Now, especially in the last year with Me Too, both for sexual assault and sexual harassment, there's a reckoning and there's an acknowledgement that we have not told the truth in the media about this story. And there's a lot of reasons that have kept us from the truth when it comes to sexual assault. Namely, there is this privacy that we generally afford the victims, and so they're not named, so they don't get a chance to tell their story. That is falling away drastically and rapidly, right? There are many, many victims who will come forward, including Dr. Ford, and describe what happened to them. And when in the past they were ashamed to do so because there was this deep stigma that was attached to being a victim of the crime. And that victims are throwing that off now, and they are coming forward and they're telling their stories. And the media is more willing to listen to them. So you see a different truth being told, a more fuller truth about sexual assault and sexual harassment. And then you enter into this particular conversation about this particular case, where it is very hard to say this definitively happened or did not definitively happen. But when you look at the broader context, there are many, many people in society who are willing to say now, yes, this happened to me, when that wasn't the case. And the media has played a role in that.
Kelly, I want to take a call from Norman, Oklahoma. Rita, what do you see when you're watching this play out?
Hi, David. I heard snippets on this station of Dr. Ford yesterday morning, but I watched on CNN Kavanaugh for hours and was totally exhausted by his outrageous equivocating. He was blatantly a skilled liar.
Well, and briefly, Rita, how do you feel the media treated that?
I felt that CNN was leaning a little leftish, but I am from Oklahoma, which is a solid red state, and I'm not accustomed to hearing anything fairly reported. PBS did clips that were very fair, I thought.
Okay. Thank you, Rita, for that call. Kelly, in about a minute or so that we've got left before the end of the segment, I wanted to ask you what would balance look like in coverage of this? What does fair mean here?
Oh, man, that's such a hard question to even answer. Mm-hmm. We have this frame that we try and cover this in of a courtroom trial. And this is, and we talk about evidence and innocent until proven guilty, but this isn't a courtroom trial. This is a job interview. It's very different. And so it's so hard to figure out what fairness would look like because we don't have a set of standards in a job interview for what you should consider and what you shouldn't consider. And that's the hardest That's the hardest part is I don't think we know what fairness would look like in this case. Some people would say fairness is this is out of bounds and nothing's been proven. You need to disregard it. And some people would say that you should go completely in the other direction, that everything is fair game. It's not a courtroom trial. We're not talking about convicting somebody of a crime. We're talking about examining his past actions. And there is not, I think that your opinion on that is going to be directly correlated to your political leanings.
We're discussing the media and the news coverage of Brett Kavanaugh, Kelly McBride, you just heard there, and Jan Costin. I'd like you both to stick around. For all of you out there listening, I want you to stick around, too. It's a vital conversation. You can join us. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and on the latest episode of How I Built This, how Stuart Butterfield failed in two companies, pivoted, and then built two amazing new companies, Flickr and Slack. Check out How I Built This wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing Brett Kavanaugh and the media. You can join the conversation. In this changing media landscape, how can news outlets effectively report the news? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Kelly McBride. She's at the Poynter Institute, writes about media ethics and the coverage of sexual assault. Also, Jan Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox, who's covered the conservative movement and also some of this hearings. It struck me that in recent days and weeks that these accusations against Judge Kavanaugh have prompted a number of prominent women journalists to talk about their own experiences. I think of Dahlia Lithwick of Slate, who's talked about this and who's been very skeptical of Kavanaugh's account. Jan Costin, what do you make of the way in which many journalists, particularly female journalists, have embraced the Me Too movement? To what extent do you think that's a coloring or affecting how they are absorbing and reporting on the Kavanaugh nomination?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that the idea that you could not be both personally affected by sexual violence or sexual assault and be able to report on the instances of sexual violence or sexual assault is a bit of a canard because, you know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can have endured something that was awful, but also be able to look carefully at court documents and acknowledge the presence or the lack of evidence in certain cases. But I do think that, you know, my own colleagues have written really extensively on the Me Too movement within journalism, which is particularly important. But I think that there's a sensibility that we know better than a lot of people do just how omnipresent sexual violence is for many women in this country, many people in this country more broadly. And I think that our ability to listen to those stories and report on those stories, which is incredibly challenging to do, is something that's been very important to me and very important to many women who are, you know, conservative, liberal. You know, I've talked to people who are within conservative institutions who've talked about their own experiences of harassment and how challenging that's been. And I think that that's something we haven't heard enough about. But I think that, you know, journalists being able to recognize, one, you know, how difficult this is for someone else. I think that there are times where we're talking about crimes, we're talking about robbery, we're talking about something, you know, manslaughter or murder. Those are crimes where I think everyone can recognize this would be very difficult. You can put yourself in the plate, in the shoes of the person who has endured this. Mm-hmm. But for sexual violence, I think for some journalists, you hear of people who are, you know, they're very, you know, questioning why the person was dressed a certain way or acting a certain way. Or, and you even heard about this a little bit with kind of some of the allegations regarding Kavanaugh of, you know, why would you keep going to these parties if terrible things happen at these parties? Not recognizing, one, you're in high school. That's, you know, you keep going to the party where the cool people are because the cool people are there. And two, not understanding that, you know, the mindset of someone who has endured sexual violence or been around sexual violence is not one that is going to be inherently logical. And, you know, I think that being able to see that and see that through both what you've experienced and what you've learned about while reporting on it is incredibly important.
Melinda Henneberg, the editorial columnist for the Kansas City Star, wrote a column titled "Don't Judge Kavanaugh's Accusers." I covered the police, and I didn't report my own rape. She wrote against what she called the usual cries about how easy it is to ruin a fine man's life, the many female and male lives that are ruined by sexual violence, and for the record, mine was not, are rarely mentioned by people so reverent about those upstanding citizens who are supposedly being unfairly besmirched by a liberal and media mob. Additionally, Karen Tumulty, a columnist covering national politics, who I believe also faced a certain kind of sexual assault that she wrote about. She said, if there's anything the Me Too movement should have taught everyone, it is that women who have personal stories of sexual abuse should be listened to. Their courage in coming forward should be respected. But it does not necessarily follow, Karen Tumulty writes, that all of their accounts will turn out to be persuasive or that it is reasonable to demand the same amount of evidence in cases that involve different sets of circumstances. Kelly McBride, one of the questions we're getting from listeners is, you know, is Professor Ford being held to a different standard in terms of respect for what she is testifying to than Judge Kavanaugh? Is she being asked to do more than he is in terms of being credible?
Well, she certainly was held to a different standard yesterday. She had a federal prosecutor examining her. She was asked to account for differences in her accounts over time. And she was asked to address very specific details. And when she didn't, she was drawn back to those. Judge Kavanaugh spent very little time with the federal prosecutor and instead was either being interviewed. He was not interviewed by a professional investigator, right? He was interviewed by politicians who were all trying to make a point in one way or the other. So yesterday it was a very different standard that she was held to. But overall, sexual assault victims in general are held to a different standard. They're asked the questions that that were just described. You know, why did you go back to the party? And they're also scrutinized for every single choice that they make, whether they did report it, whether they didn't report it, whether they were traumatized too much by it, whether they weren't traumatized enough by it. Every single decision or reaction that a sexual assault survivor has is scrutinized and used to determine her authenticity. And you saw that yesterday. I mean, even one of the senators commented on how she seemed to be a very good-looking, well-spoken person, yeah. And that somehow went to her credibility, right?
Yeah, that was it was a kind of incredible moment. I also wonder about the kinds of conversations that are being prompted by this, particularly on – if you think about cable news on Wednesday on CNN, Michael Caputo, a former Trump campaign aide who's, I guess, become a political analyst, seemed to lose his composure when experiencing the claim that the media was only covering Kavanaugh when he was making the claim that the media was only covering Kavanaugh and the allegations in order to get ratings. Caputo, you hear his voice speaking first. He's followed then by USA Today columnist Kirsten Powers and then CNN's legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin.
From now on, every mother of sons, every grandmother of grandsons has to fear for the future of their boys because of people like you who sit here and take uncorroborated testimony, uncorroborated allegations against a decent man and ruin him because it gets you ratings. Enough of that.
That's bonkers. Literally insane.
I hope young men who sexually assault young women get their lives ruined. I mean, I'm not worried about that.
We'll take a couple of calls. Bill is calling from Tampa, Florida. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, thank you. It's the comment that that gentleman just made is what's upsetting and what really upsets a lot of people. I don't know if you all have ever been falsely accused, but when you're falsely accused, your life is ruined forever. And there are so many who are falsely accused. And I blame most of this on the media because it's always a sensationalization that they're interested in. The media in general, and I'm again, I understand I'm using a wide paintbrush here, the media in general sensationalizes everything to the point where we end up today.
Thanks for that, Bill. I appreciate that. The media is sensationalizing things. We also have a call from Boston. Gilda, go ahead.
Hi, David.
Hi,
so, you know, my interpretation looking at different news outlets, either on the right and left that has covered the story, is that there's a clear bias of the right inserting their interpretation of who is wrong and who is right. If you look at, let's say, Fox News, and when you look at more liberal outlets, it's more laying down the facts without even putting in any probing questions for readers or listeners to start thinking about, oh, you know, this is an interesting question. I didn't thought about that. So I think there is a clear bias on how the two sides are representing this story. And I do believe that the media has a responsibility not only to report what it is to report, but also to probe readers and listeners to start thinking about various aspects of that story. Otherwise, you know, we can all go and probably find the facts on our own. So I think that is where, you know, the responsibility of the media lies. And to be honest, when I read the stories on New York Times, on New Yorker, nobody even, like, touched on the fact that, you know, just as a question, not to imply anything, but if somebody, you know, trying to be appointed for the highest court of the country, you know, for lifetime, you know, is saying that he's innocent, why wouldn't he say just for once throughout this whole process that he welcomes an FBI investigation if the senators, you know, and the country is saying that is what they want?
All right, Gilda, thank you for that. The question of the FBI, the question about what kinds of evidence has come to the fore plays a role. Earlier today, Republican Arizona Senator Jeff Flake said he has doubts about Kavanaugh's account about whether Kavanaugh assaulted Ford, but says he would vote to confirm based on a presumption of innocence, which Flake says is what binds us to the rule of law. Kelly McBride, what's the standard for the press in levying serious allegations against someone like Kavanaugh?
Well, again, Senator Flake is defaulting back to a legal proceeding, whether you can convict him. And I think that for the most part, everybody believes that you can't based on this evidence. But for the press, while we come at it from a legal proceeding, because that's what we're familiar with, we're also very aware of this moment that we're in time where our standards are changing. I think your caller right there had a great point of our job is to help people make sense of this information, and we may not be doing a very good job on that. One of the questions that I would love to see someone probe in the media is the fact that even if Dr. Ford had reported this in 1982, I'm pretty sure that most police officers in 1982, as they applied the statutes about sexual assault, did not consider what happened a sexual assault, even though by today's standards we would. It is in 1982 that would have been considered boys being boys. Now, I'm not suggesting that is the way that we should interpret that, But to bring more context and more analysis, especially when we're talking about these vast sweeping periods of time where our standards have changed, part of our job in the media is to bring awareness to that. And the reason that it's so hard is that most people are getting their information in really quick updates. Now she said this. Now he's crying in the hearing room. Now there's a second accuser. We're getting them in snippets, and it takes a lot of time and space and skill and analysis to provide that contextual framework that allows people to see how complicated these issues really are.
Kelly McBride, so it seems to me there's two possibilities here, maybe more. But one is that we've you know, we are reporting now, you're seeing from the perspective of the Me Too moment, much more awareness, or that we've fallen back into the rhythms of he said, she said, extraordinary allegations, extraordinary defiance in response of what we saw in 1991. Where's the press landed?
Well, I think we're definitely looking at this in a he said, she said framework. And you can see that when you look at the way most news outlets reported on the story. You know, many news outlets today and yesterday were using this split screen video treatment where you see both Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh taking the oath, swearing not to perjure themselves, and then we're bouncing back and forth between the most emotional moments of the testimony when they testified for hours and hours. And I was struck by how many news outlets picked exactly the same moments. So, right, it's a very sensational treatment of it.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, you go.
All right. Well, Jane Costin, I wanted to ask you a little bit. One of the extraordinary things that gets overlooked, but I think is important in this context, is to think about what Kavanaugh did prior to Thursday's hearings. And that is he sat down with an anchor for Fox News. It was a news anchor, Martha McCallum, but nonetheless, a really important outlet, particularly for the political right. Why was that a remarkable thing for him to do?
Well, I think that it was it kind of reminded me, if anyone remembers, in 1992 when Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton appeared on 60 Minutes to talk about allegations of Bill Clinton being involved in extramarital affairs. And it was an interesting moment because it really marked a strong demarcation between what many of Kavanaugh's biggest defenders have been saying and what Kavanaugh himself has been saying. Because interestingly, Kavanaugh has never used the boys will be boys, I may have done these things, but I did do this thing. He's never said that. He has denied every part of these allegations. He said he's never been blackout drunk. But I think that Fox, it was also interesting because how Kavanaugh sounded yesterday and how Kavanaugh sounded during that Fox News interview were two very different things. He was really framing himself as, you know, kind of a, you know, he'd been unfairly accused, but his wife was standing with him, and that this was a, you know, this was a family. This was a family unit. They were standing together. And then you saw yesterday a much more angry, and I think that to many conservatives, righteously angry Kavanaugh.
Jane, in the minute that we have left, one of the things that you're speaking to is you're comparing him to a presidential candidate. Supreme Court justices don't do this. And the idea of doing the interview, it also struck me this is what? The favorite news outlet of the right, but also the favorite news outlet of who? President Trump.
Right. And it was interesting because you see that's very much speaking to President Trump in a very direct way. It's very much, you know, this is about talking to an audience of one, President Trump. And you saw that a little bit, you know, there was some back and forth reporting during the hearings yesterday, but then Trump came out last night, said, you know, I fully support Kavanaugh. This is why I nominated him for the Supreme Court. But it is interesting that, you know, I've been joking that does anyone remember the Supreme Court nomination hearings of like Samuel Alito? This is not generally how this works. This is not a presidential run. This is a nominee for the highest court in the land, but a high court that is supposed to be the check on executive power and on Congress
and everything
like,
else.
On the laws it creates.
And everything else.
And everything else.
You've been hearing the voice of Jane Costin. She is senior politics reporter with Vox. Jane, great to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you've also heard from Kelly McBride. She's the senior vice president at Poynter and a leading thinker on journalist and ethics. Great to talk to you again, Kelly.
You bet, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser. We've had help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Peary. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.